Welcome to the Paleo View. I'm Stacey Toth of PaleoParents.com. You might also know me as the broth lady, or the inventor of the hashtag More Vegetables Than a Vegetarian. I'm the co-author of several paleo cookbooks, including Eat Like a Dinosaur, Beyond Bacon, Real Life Paleo. I like to talk about health at any size, and self-love, and personal acceptance. Specifically, I have a love for lifting heavy things. If you're interested in finding more out about that, you can also find me on Strong Woman Radio.
And I'm Dr. Sarah Valentine, the PaleoMom.com. I'm the New York Times best-selling author of The Paleo Approach and The Paleo Approach Cookbook. I'm passionate about nutrient density and the intersection of diet and lifestyle with health, which really means I just love talking about science.
News and Views, where Sarah and I catch up, and you get to listen to our gossip. All right. Welcome to the Paleo View, everybody. This week, we are joined by the awesome Diana Rogers, who has been on the podcast before previously to talk about her nutritional therapy practice, which was actually the impetus for me to get my digestion under control. But today she's on the show to talk about her upcoming book, Homegrown Paleo, to give us a little 101 on homesteading and more. I think, well,
oh, the whole range. Let's go from homesteading to urban farming to backyard vegetable patches to container gardens. Because I think what Diana knows so much about and what I really want to pick her brain about is like how to grow your own food, especially when that's not necessarily something that many of us grow up doing anymore, and it's not necessarily something that we've seen, so it's really hard to be familiar with, and it's really intimidating. And Diana's the master. We get to do a podcast with the master. It's awesome.
Well,
she will teach us young Padawans. Yes.
For those of you who don't know the master, Diana blogs at Sustainable Dish, and I met you first at PaleoFX, but visiting your farm, Clark Farm, at AHS, was the second AHS. You hosted the sustainable dinner in your farm barn.
Oh, and I still remember the stories of that meal.
It was just a spectacular event. Like you planned it just perfectly, from the food to the ambiance, and you know, obviously the company was great. So that has been the extent of my experience, but I've seen other people visit your farm, and I've seen a lot of the posts and videos and stuff that you've done. And I happen to know that you've been working on this book for like 2 years or a very long time in order to give the seasonality of it, and working with a professional photographer to take just the most amazing photographs of not just your farm, but Homegrown Paleo is also a cookbook with a ton of amazing looking recipes. So welcome to the Paleo
View. Thank you. And I am so excited to be talking to you guys about this. And also I wanted to just let folks know that even if they're not in a position right now to be growing their own food, it's still an awesome book for them to have, because understanding sustainable growing practices is really critical in order to be a great consumer, like at the farmer's market, to, you know, ask intelligent questions like, you know, not asking, are these grass-fed chickens or something like that, because chickens don't eat grass. So the information that I have in here, I tried to make it very approachable and not intimidating. We have some really great diagrams, really, as you mentioned, beautiful images of my farm and lots of other little trips that we took on the side. So we went camping, and we do a little section on how to go camping and how to have a clam bake. So it really kind of covers not only homesteading and growing food, but also cooking, and then sort of the lifestyle of paleo, right? Like the whole downshifting, the whole getting out into nature and really unwinding. So I tried to cover those three topics in the book.
I love that you said that, because that was actually on my notes of things to talk about. This idea that people need to understand the source of their foods is something that everybody in the community has been talking about for a really long time. And I've addressed it tangentially on the blog and the podcast and my books, and I know Sarah's done the same. And I think this idea of really honestly teaching people kind of what a healthy farm looks like, and like you said, about it in general so that you can ask intelligent questions, is amazing. I think the other component of that that you didn't mention is that, you know, in the book, I've seen photos of your kids and your family on the farm, and this concept of sharing this idea of homegrown food, or really just food that's not out of your control, right? Like, if you don't know the circumstances of the food, is really where we try to not go. And I think that this book could be a wonderful tool for families to get in touch with where their food is coming from and really get kids excited with, oh, I could have this delicious looking food, and I could get these foods from a farmer's market that was raised in an ethical way. Or, hey, mommy, can we plant cauliflower this year because the soup or whatever looks really good? And I could see it as a tool that we would be able to use with our boys. Our boys already love gardening and give us a hard time about not doing it because I have a black thumb, and it's not something that I make time for because I'm not good at it. So, I could see it being used as a really great tool in that capacity.
Yeah, definitely. And we see, so we run a CSA here. So for folks that don't know what that is, it's a community supported agriculture. So we grow a little bit of everything. We have animals, and we grow a little bit of just about every vegetable that you could find in the Northeast. And so people come once a week, and we harvest a lot of it for them. So they come to our farm, and we tell them, okay, this week you get, you know, this much lettuce and this much bunches of radishes. And they kind of go around in a farmer's market type of setting. But then we also have pick your own. And so one week it might be strawberries. They might get a quart of strawberries. Another week it might be like, gosh, by August or September, it could take over an hour to do the pick your own because there's just so many string beans and herbs and cherry tomatoes. And when the kids have this connection to their food, whether they're growing it themselves or even just visiting a farm on a regular basis that they feel comfortable at, they're so much more likely to try it. So, and a strawberry, like fresh from the field when it's still warm, is, there's just nothing like it. So it's really magical to experience to have with your kids.
Yeah. My kids love pick your own, and it's the middle ground that we've found for what we are capable of, but yet can still be involved with where the food is coming from without the work and me killing things. So
right. So this book I think is great for you, Stacey, because like you said, you're just not in a place right now where growing, maybe you've got other things that you're spending your attention on, but you still maybe want to go visit a farm and it's still interesting to you, right? Because how could food production not be interesting? I mean, to everybody, right? So anyway, I explain everything that goes into raising, you know, sustainable animals, from rotational grazing to, you know, if you were going to get a meat share, how big of a freezer do you need for, you know, that meat share for a lamb or for half a cow? Like, what does half a cow look like when it's all frozen and cut up? You know, so I really tried to look at this from someone like you, who's kind of new to everything. And we ran it by a lot of people just to make sure that, you know, everything was really clear and accessible.
Awesome. I'm excited.
Yeah.
Sarah does a better job gardening than me.
Do you have a garden, Sarah?
I have a very small area of garden that is mixed, usually edible flowers and herbs, and sometimes I've got some chard in it right now, which is not too happy with the cold weather, but I'm hoping we'll bounce back in the spring. and some radicchio in it. So it's sort of like a just a mix. But I have a pretty good container herb garden, and then I usually mix in, you know, just the easy stuff to grow. So, you know, kale, various types of lettuces, those types of things that are sort of easy. And then I can maybe not get a full salad out of my container garden, but I can get like the really good flavor to add to, you know, whatever greens I got at the farmer's market. So I kind of garden in a, it's very focused on like herbs and the adding the flavor in those fresh herbs and having those. We have a lot of critters who enjoy eating things here. So
you're
giving them
a salad bowl right there.
So if I wanted to really do a vegetable patch, I'd also have to be building netting, and then it just becomes a very big job. So it's something that I've kind of always wanted to do because I grew up gardening. We grew up actually extremely poor, and so what we ended up doing was we ended up fishing all of our own fish and picking all of our own shellfish off the rocks and growing all of our own vegetables. So I grew up, you know, doing that, and it's something that I would love to kind of get back to. But I live in such a different climate from where I grew up, with such different pests from where I grew up. So it's sort of like, you know, I've got this base of knowledge, but it's a base of knowledge for a completely different type of growing season and climate and different kinds of, you know, fruits and vegetables compared to here. So it's even just growing herbs has been a bit of a learning curve. I've got these squirrels who just think that I plant them for them, and they just sit in the flower pots and they like pick something with their hands first, and then they start to eat it. And then we've got rabbits and chipmunks, and we've got possums. Apparently they like to eat your stuff. Like, it's like,
yeah,
I'm just planting stuff for the neighborhood wildlife, basically. But I have a pretty successful little herb container garden in my backyard.
Yeah, so herbs are really great. They're one of my recommended ways for people who don't have a lot of space to start. And I noticed on your Instagram, Sarah, that you had asked questions, and so that was one of the people on there was asking, like, what's the easiest thing? How do I get started? What's the easiest vegetables? And so herbs would be the number one thing, also because it's expensive, right?
And
those, you know, we've all written cookbooks. So buying fresh herbs every single week, especially if you just want a little like basil, mint, and thyme, and maybe some oregano or chives or rosemary. So you have to spend like $2.50 per handful.
Bunch, yeah.
Yeah. If you just want a little bit. So you can really get a lot of bang for your buck out of growing your own herbs. So that's great.
Yeah. So that person actually, Claire, she actually also asked for like a small backyard garden.
Mm-hmm.
Like, where would you, like, she was like, best starter veggies. So like, where would you go from there? We've had some good luck with carrots and kale. And we've actually had good luck with broccoli in Atlanta.
Good.
We have the trick of keeping everything watered enough that the aphids don't eat it. Like, it's a really interesting continuous battle with the climate. What would be your like go-to vegetables? I don't know where she lives, but like, so let's just say, I don't know. What would be an average climate in America?
Yeah, I have that. For every vegetable, I do have our favorite varieties that we like to grow here on the farm. And that's all in the book. But then for people who are just starting out, tomatoes are really, really easy and very prolific, especially cherry tomatoes. And we love these ones called Sun Gold, which are those bright orange ones. I don't know if you've ever tried those, but they're really, really great. They're really sweet. Eggplant is actually very easy, but not AIP. But it's easy to grow. Lettuce is easy to grow, but it doesn't like it hot. So most lettuce likes it kind of cool. But it's so funny because in the middle of summer, people, you know, when it's 90 degrees, all you want to eat is a salad.
When you want a salad. Yeah.
Right.
For us, we grow it basically fall and spring.
Mm-hmm.
That's when we grow almost everything here. We can't grow anything in my backyard in the summer.
Yeah, right. And so, but we do have some varieties that we found that work really good in the summer, for even for lettuce. And then peppers are easy. Again, not AIP. And I should mention to the AIP folks, actually, that every recipe I have in here is labeled either Whole30, AIP, nut-free, egg-free, or dairy-free. So that's just to make it easier for folks. And then summer squash. So that is AIP. And it's, I mean, zucchini and yellow summer squash are just super easy to grow. They can easily take over. They can get really big, really fast. And it's a lot of fun. So, and then Swiss chard is the other one that you mentioned. And kale would be easy too. So they like it a little bit cooler. So for everything, you just have to read about it and make sure that you're, you know, planting it at the right time and that you're giving it enough water for sure, because that's a really easy thing. People forget, or they go away and they'll forget that they have these plants that, you know, they'll have someone come walk their dog, but then they'll forget to have someone water their garden while they're gone too.
Those were things that we grew a lot of when I was a kid, was summer and winter squash. And we used to grow these zucchinis that were like 2 feet long, right? And like 6 inches around. And we would eat nothing but zucchini for like 4 months straight. Mm-hmm. I've had really good luck in Atlanta with sweet potatoes as well. So
yeah,
they like this climate.
I was going to say that we're in a really temperate place. The Northern Virginia area is really lucky with the Shenandoah to have almost like you were saying, Sarah, it's difficult for you in the summertime. Our summers aren't quite as hot, although we don't do a lot of lettuce and stuff here. But I found that us personally, despite having a very black thumb, that we did okay with things that were just really hearty in general. And those being like root vegetables, like potatoes, sweet potatoes, mm-hmm. beets, carrots, things that kind of grew underground and were difficult for us to mess up because we forget to weed and we forget to go out and check on them. We forget mm-hmm. to water them. And things that are under the ground seem to be a bit protected from our failures. And the other thing that I was really surprised about doing well in our garden was cauliflower, and we really enjoyed watching it grow. That and Brussels sprouts were like the two most interesting things for us, because when you buy them in the store, it's been removed from how mm-hmm. it grows. You know, like you buy a head of cauliflower, or you buy usually just individual Brussels sprouts. And so watching the Brussels sprouts grow on a stalk was really interesting for us, because we were like, what's happening? Where are the Brussels sprouts coming from? Like, when do we get to eat them?
Yeah. When I go to farmers markets, that's, I don't do that anymore, but I used to for years and years. I was the girl at the farmers market selling things. And so we would just sell them whole on the stalk, the Brussels sprouts. And it was the number one thing that people just loved, walking around with this like club of Brussels sprouts.
Yes.
Beautiful. Like, you could put it in a vase and make it a centerpiece. I mean, I just think that it's one of the most beautiful, because it's like, you know, that there's flowers that sort of have that same, I mean, that's what it is, right? It's the flower, but it sort of has that same structure as like bluebells or lupin or something like that. And mm-hmm. to me, it's, but it's like that, but giant. And so to me, it's got this, I don't know. I think they're gorgeous. I get so excited when I see them on the stalk. Then I also know that they're really fresh and they're going to taste amazing.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say, I think our plan for when it is our plan to do a garden this year, because we are trying to do more things like that and less things that take away from the family. And I think it would be good for us to kind of have a family garden this year. My plan was actually to grow things that are on the Dirty Dozen list, particularly focus on the items that are the most expensive on the Dirty Dozen list, because I think that the most bang that we're going to get is really for our buck, you know? And I think when you were talking about like tomatoes and peppers, if you're not AIP, I think that those are really great options for people, because they're so expensive in the stores, but they're so easy to grow yourself. And they're also really problematic in terms of pesticides. So it's like, you know, you get so many things, you get the benefit of so many things if you just do them yourself.
And especially tomatoes, like there is nothing that matches the flavor of like
hot out of the sun
tomatoes,
like especially that. If you have your own basil and like good sea salt, like that's all. I'm gonna pretend like I have had that in the last few years.
Yeah, and I have tried I have tried all the heirloom varieties. I've tried everything, and we have all our favorite varieties of tomatoes and how to sucker them. So I should also mention that
What is suckering a tomato?
Suckering a tomato. So that's removing – so a tomato is a vine. Yes. And it wants to climb, and it will – you want all the energy from that tomato plant to go into producing fruit, to producing tomatoes. But if you don't take off the little they're called suckers, which are just new leaves that are starting – because the plant wants to get as big as it possibly can. So you don't want it to get super big. You want it to put energy into the fruit. So you need to pinch off these little extra – suckers that these little extra leaves that are coming off the plant. And so we describe it in the book, but then we also have started a video series on YouTube, and they're also on my blog, and we actually have a whole maybe it's like 3 minutes long of my husband Andrew explaining how to prune and sucker tomatoes. So people should watch that too.
Do you guys have videos on weeding? Because I'll be honest with you, this is our number one issue. Mm-hmm. We have soil that is very, I don't know the word for it. There's a lot of clay in our soil. Mm-hmm. And when we've done our garden previously, we've gone and gotten organic, not just topsoil, but...
soil conditioner?
Yeah, like the manure. It's just basically straight manure that we're mm-hmm. mixing in with the clay and then putting the soil on, and it does a really great job of reducing the clay and allowing the food to grow, but it also invites everything under the sun to grow mm-hmm. in there. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. the weeding, if we're not on top of it like every other day, becomes this project that then is like, oh, it's not worth it. I can't go out there. It's going to be 2 hours in the hot sun. Like, do you have tips on how to handle that?
So yeah, we do. And my husband is really into weeding and being very proactive and on top of it. So he does say that it, you know, sometimes it gets to a point where if you haven't paid attention, it's better to just till the whole thing under and start over again. And so he does have recommendations for preparing your beds and getting everything ready, and then weed it, and then plant, you know, your plants. Weed again, weed when they're tiny, tiny, when you can't even hardly even see them. And then using mulch on top of the soil around your plants in order to prevent. And sometimes mulch can even be, it's not as attractive, but newspaper, or you can use straw, but anything that covers the dirt so that weeds can't come up and compete with the plants.
So you said there's diagrams in there. Is there, mm-hmm. is there something to help me know what a brand new seedling is versus a weed? Because mm-hmm. I feel like that's the trouble that we get into, is when they're coming up and they're small, I'm like, I don't know what it's supposed to look like. I'm just going to wait.
So a lot of things we actually recommend that you buy as transplants and not start as seeds. So there's some things that you have to start as seeds, but a lot of things you can, like tomato plants, we actually recommend that you buy them already strong and healthy from a garden center, like a local garden center, not like a big box store where they're grown in big, you know, factories with lots of disease, because that's how like the blight got up here. So we recommend going to like your little organic farm. Usually little farms will have a seedling sale, so they'll grow extra in their greenhouse. And so you can get herbs and tomatoes and your little chard starters, all that stuff as transplants. And then you can just pop the transplants in, and then they're bigger than the weeds already. So that's a really great way to go. But then other things like carrots, you do have to sow directly into the ground. And so making a line with your finger and planting the carrots, you know, only in that line, and then keeping everything around that completely weed free is a good way to go.
I feel like such a failure in buying those little transplant already grown plants. So I really appreciate your affirmation that it's okay to buy those.
It's okay. It's recommended.
I like that they come in little compostable containers now too. Have you seen those where you are?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you just kind of rip off the bottom and you plant the whole thing in the pot.
Yeah, you don't have to rip off the bottom at all. Like it's in a pot that biodegrades. And so it's like made out of cardboard. Yeah. It's like made out of like a cardboard that disintegrates.
you're supposed to kind of rip open the bottom to let the roots.
Yeah, maybe there's like a small hole. I was just saying, like, it's not like I remember growing up and our families having like a huge stack of those plastic bins of like buying the stuff. And so I feel really badly about doing that. And also I felt like a failure with not growing things from seeds and 100% organic and blah, 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 blah. So, okay. I feel better. I feel like I could do that. I could do that.
You can do it. And so the other tips would be to pick really full sun. It's just best if you have. And so I vaguely remember your backyard, Stacey, and I feel like it was kind of shady.
So like our side yard is where we do our garden. I don't know if you saw our side yard, but it's the only place that gets a lot of sun other than the front yard. And we put a fig tree in the front yard and it did really well, so well that the squirrels eat all of our figs.
Oh, that's a bummer. Squirrels are hard.
Squirrels!
I'm telling you, we're just really bad at growing food. we're bad at growing anything. I killed a cactus. I mean, it's a situation.
Other than fruits and vegetables, you also have a whole variety of animals that you grow for food on your farm, right?
Yes.
What do you grow? I want to geek out over growing meat.
Okay. So on our farm, we have chickens for eggs. We currently are not raising chickens for meat. So we only keep our chickens for eggs, but we have in the past raised chickens for meat. And I have instructions on, you know, if you want to do that, the breeds we recommend and how to go about that. And we also have goats, which are hysterical, really, really funny. And they're actually quite sustainable, really good nutrition source and all that. I make goat cheese as well. And not for sale. I make goat cheese like for fun, like in my kitchen.
Sounds like fun.
Yeah. And let's say we have sheep, which is my favorite protein, lamb. Yeah. And we breed the goats and sheep. So right now it's wintertime and our barn is full of pregnant goats and sheep. And then we have pigs that we run through the woods. And we don't breed the pigs here on the farm, although we're thinking about doing that. And, so right now we buy the pigs in the spring and then we keep them, we feed them all spring, summer and fall. And then we take them to be processed in usually November, December. And those are heritage breed pigs usually. It's pretty much whatever we can get. So we always try. This past year, we had some beautiful Tamworth pigs. They were gorgeous. They're like a dark red color and their bacon is.
Those are my recommended pigs. I have tried them all.
Yeah.
That's my favorite breed. I happen to be an expert on the topic. You're doing good stuff over there.
And then I feel like I'm forgetting something. We have some ducks as well. Those are more for practice for our dogs for herding because we have sheep dogs and we train them on the ducks. So the ducks all want to stay in their little flock together. So we'll usually get about a dozen Indian runner ducks, which are the tall black. They look like Daffy Duck. Like they look like little nuns running around the farm or like little bowling pins or something. Like they look like you could knock them over. And they seriously do get stuck sometimes. Like, you know, I don't know if you have these by your house where there's like the basement window and there's like that little kind of area where your lawn might go down a little bit right before the basement window.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm talking about? I don't know. That's probably called something. I don't know. But anyway, at one point, all the ducks got stuck down there. Like in just their head, they couldn't get out. It was hysterical. Anyway, so it's a lot of fun. So we have all those animals and we also have instructions on beekeeping in the book. And actually, Steph Goudreau is going to be keeping some bees. I'm her bee coach. So she's
I saw her doing that. I was super like, hey, that was smart. A little bit jealous that she had figured something out like that.
Yeah.
I hate to interrupt you, but it just made me think of like maybe you could also touch on for people like myself who live in a county that is very restrictive of things that they classify as non-pet animals and what's allowed and what's not allowed. what are some ideas and alternatives that you could mention, like bees? I don't know if you have any other ideas. I wrote this article on like keeping deers in your backyard and that somehow being allowed in some counties because there's naturally deer in, especially in my area.
Don't deer normally have a really like wide ranging, like,
I don't know how you could keep, I mean, I would have to get a really high fence because we have, I think we have deer that come in. We also have foxes in our neighborhood, which is another reason why I don't think that chickens would work well. But, I mean, I would have to be super careful, and I've told you what I'd do to cactuses. So I just don't think I'm ready for that kind of commitment. But anyway, maybe as you're kind of going through these sort of things, you could talk about what are some options for people, like even urban. Not just with a yard, but yes, even kind of more urban in general.
Yeah. So you can keep bees anywhere. And when I first talked to Steph about, you know, she wanted to keep bees and I hooked her up with the San Diego Beekeeping Association. A lot of times, like for us, we have a beekeeper that keeps our bees for us on our farm because farmers can't do everything. And there's people who love bees and that's kind of their thing. And so people like my brother, in fact, lives in downtown Philadelphia, like downtown. And he's a beekeeper and he's got a farm that he keeps his bees. And every weekend he goes out and he checks on his bees, not in the winter so much, but during the bee season in the warmer months. And so people might forget that, you know, just because you don't have the space, there's community gardens, there's, you know, there's other options. If they want to get their hands dirty, they could volunteer on a farm, all that kind of stuff. As far as like restrictions, like if you live in a more kind of suburban area, I would say, you know, definitely ask about the chicken thing because, well, when my husband and I, so we both did not grow up farming and we lived in suburbia. We lived on this quarter acre plot in Framingham, Massachusetts that was this little subdivision from 1947 where everyone had exactly the same house and exactly the same stamp.
That's, you know, suburbia.
Yeah. So we did live that way. We tore up our whole front yard into raised beds. And this is when I was like working in Boston and, you know, we weren't like farming, you know? So the whole front yard was all raised beds. And this was also like, my husband was like, I'm not mowing. Like, I think it's ridiculous to buy a lawnmower for this little tiny patch of grass. I'm not mowing. Let's just eat our front lawn. So that's what we did there. And then we had to go in front of the town selectmen in order to get our permit to have chickens. And so it was really funny. So the town made us get permission from all our abutting neighbors. And so we had a yes and a yes from left and right. And then we bordered a cemetery on the back and we had a no opinion. Is that funny? From the people in the cemetery, like the father, it was a Catholic cemetery. So he just said no opinion on the chickens. It was really funny. But then the guys, the selectmen, the people making the decision asked us how we were possibly going to have any eggs if we couldn't have a rooster.
That was on my list of questions to ask you.
Mm-hmm.
So I understand that eggs are created without being fertilized. Mm-hmm. And you do not actually need a rooster in order to have hens create eggs.
Mm-hmm.
But does having, because where I live, we're allowed to have 6 chickens,
mm-hmm.
but no roosters.
Right.
And so do the roosters other than, do they keep that, like, what is their contribution to the dynamics of the chickens in the backyard? Because do they protect them? Do they keep them in line? Do they get their hormones going and stimulate more egg production? Or do they just make a lot of noise?
I don't know that I've ever enjoyed hearing you ask a question before in my life.
Because I'm trying to ask this question in a rated G kind of way.
And I enjoyed every minute of that struggle. Sorry, Diana.
That's really funny. So there's a lot of questions that come up like that, that I think people are almost a little bit embarrassed to ask, you know, or like, can chickens fly or whatever? So actually in the beginning of every chapter, I have a whole bunch of wacky questions like that. Is the chicken going to peck my eyes out? You know,
oh my gosh.
Things like that, you know?
I had never thought of that.
Well, we polled a million people. Like, I don't know if I'm friends with you on Facebook,
yeah,
but anyway, I would go onto my Facebook account and constantly say like, suppose suppose you were reading a book on homesteading. What do you think would be this question? But anyway, so
I've been on farm tours and have definitely heard a lot of the, I looked at the, one of the chicken, I think you called it frequently asked questions section. Mm-hmm. And, those are a lot of the questions that I heard people ask when we go on farm tours at our local farm.
Mm-hmm. So it's okay. Cause you know, we're all completely removed from our food and our, and the growing process. And so people just don't know. So anyhow, you don't have to have, so the chicken's going to ovulate anyway and drop an egg, and the rooster doesn't really have much to do with that process of how frequently the eggs are dropped or anything like that. So the egg frequency really has to do with light. So like right now we are getting no eggs, no eggs at all because it's so dark and the chickens are just not laying eggs. But we do, so you don't have to have a rooster in order to have like your six chickens in your backyard. So if you wanted to have some hens, you know, roosters definitely are a little more aggressive than hens. They don't always start out more aggressive, but they can become more aggressive. And so that's not always a pleasant thing to have, especially if you have like a cute little backyard and cute little children and, you know, this mean rooster. So I actually have a recipe for big bad rooster soup in my book, which is a story that happened when my son, who was like three at the time, was being terrorized by this big bad rooster. So there is a role though for roosters, and we do like to have a handful of roosters with our flock. So we have hundreds of chickens at our farm, and what the roosters do is they protect the chickens. So they will be on the lookout all the time. And if you sit there and watch, and actually we have another video of this too, where Andrew's talking about why I have a rooster, and we're actually, I zoomed in really close so you could see this rooster. So all the other hens are out there pecking at the grass and finding bugs and eating little pieces of grass and stuff. That rooster is walking around and he's not eating anything. He is just looking around. And the minute maybe a hawk flies over, or even funny enough, an airplane flies over, he lets all the hens know, and they all go running right underneath the hen house or to take cover. And so that's one of his jobs. And another job is to break up any fights. So there definitely is a pecking order for chickens. And so the rooster kind of keeps them all in line. And then, of course, he wants to be fertilizing those eggs. So he pretty much keeps busy with all that. And I don't know how he keeps any weight on, because I hardly ever see roosters eat. That's all they're doing the whole time. So, and they're beautiful.
And like, and you too, with the euphemisms. I'm sorry, Sarah, you were about to say something.
I just got really distracted by visions of roosters. But that's why you want just a couple of roosters for an entire flock of hens, right? Because what do you call chickens?
Flock.
Mm-hmm. Flock. Excellent. I had it right the first time. Because I'm assuming it's kind of like, I know about fish because I have a fish tank, that the boys kind of pester the girls. And so you want a lot of girls to spread the love.
Yes.
So that they don't get stressed by being pestered by boys.
So there's a lot of sayings in our culture that come from farms and like pecking order. But anyway, yeah. And roosters they'll pick a favorite, unfortunately, sometimes, and that poor hen. And so it is better to have quite a few girls for the one boy. Yeah.
Does it like really stress out the hen?
Yeah.
And does that not end well typically?
It does not end well.
But the good news is you don't need a rooster. So for someone who doesn't have a huge flock or something.
Right. If I was going to have six chickens in my backyard.
So if you were going to have six chickens in your backyard, I would recommend that you go somewhere and buy the chickens already sexed, meaning that they already know that they're all girls, so that you don't mm-hmm. accidentally end up with a rooster, which can happen sometimes when you mail order for chicks. Actually, Liz Wolf and I talked about that because that happened to her.
I just have to say the words mail order for chicks.
Yep.
Is a completely different context from how that sentence is probably normally used.
Yeah. So you can buy them. They'll ship you chicks in the mail. And there's beautiful different, you know, breeds, and you might want to pick out a whole bunch of different breeds. But then in order to keep that box warm, they'll throw in some extras for you, which might seem awesome at first until you realize that they're roosters. And let me just let you know that no farm wants extra roosters. Like, nobody wants your extra rooster. Nobody anywhere wants your extra rooster.
If you've got an extra rooster, you're making...
You're making big bad rooster soup. That's what you're doing with that rooster. Yeah.
So is it hard to process chickens on your own in your backyard? Or is that something that you want to... Like, because, I mean, if I... Like, even the farmers that I know locally, they bring, I don't know what they do with their chickens, but I know that for their pigs or their cows or, you know, mm-hmm. lamb, that they bring it to a processor that's, you know, that's all they do. And they don't process the meat themselves. I don't know if they do chicken or not. But if I was going to have, like, I've got one extra rooster, like, what mm-hmm. am I going to do? How do I get that? How does that rooster go from being alive in my backyard to being, like, in a pot on my stove?
So I recommend to people that they watch someone else do it first. So there's some good videos online. I did not produce a video on this. And I didn't put the instructions in the book because it's a cookbook, but I did give people pointers and direct them to resources to learn more about it. So basically, you know, it's something that I think people who have chickens should be prepared to do, because it's just sort of part of being a chicken owner, you know? So they could find, you know, my husband Andrew actually will go help people sometimes who are in this situation, and he'll just kind of show them how to do it so that they can do it on their own. But it's like one of those, like, put on your big girl panties and figure it out, because it's sort of part of the deal if you're going to have chickens. There aren't a lot of places where you can bring a chicken, unfortunately. So farmers, if they want to sell their meat, they have to bring their larger animals to a slaughterhouse. So we bring our pigs to a humane slaughterhouse and the sheep as well. And I have instructions in the book on, you know, if you want to raise those animals, how to find a slaughterhouse and what makes a slaughterhouse humane and all those things. But with chickens, and actually with rabbits too, there's not really a lot of places, you know, just because there's not a lot of people doing it that much anymore. And so there's just not a lot of resources. And it actually is more stressful on the bird to put it in a cage and put it in a truck and bring it somewhere than it is to just, like, quickly do it at your house. So
that makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay. So I have another chicken question.
Mm-hmm.
So salmonella.
Mm-hmm.
Well, chickens have salmonella. Like, we have this, like, thing where, like, if you buy chicken in the grocery store, 50% of chicken is contaminated with salmonella in the grocery store, which is why you have to cook chicken so well. And I actually took when my youngest was a baby, so my youngest was just attached to me and a carrier the whole time, but I took my oldest to a local urban chicken farm. And we kind of, you know, we got the tour, we hung out with the chickens, we got to bring home eggs, but there was this whole thing of, like, make sure you wash the eggs really well, don't, like, you know, like, they were like, you don't want your kid to get salmonella. And so when I think about, like, my kids sharing my backyard with six chickens,
mm-hmm.
and I think about a backyard covered in chicken poo.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think about my kids playing in chicken poo. And then I think about salmonella. Like, is that something that's actually a concern? Like, if I wanted to do this, would I have to figure out how to have the chickens area and the kids area? Or is this something that's sort of like a, you know, it's a problem for industrially produced chickens, but when you've got them in your backyard, you don't need to worry about it?
So chicken poop is really gross, and it's slimy, and you definitely do not want your barefoot child stepping in it. Okay. So you definitely would want to have a chicken area and a kid area, and the two should not meet. And so we do not let our children. I know, like, barefoot is really popular in the paleo community and everything. We never let our kids walk around barefoot. Farms are not a safe place. There's all kinds of really bad bacteria that live in animal feces, you know, including salmonella. So
wasn't it you that had the video about, was it one of your animals was obsessed with somebody's boots on the farm?
Oh yeah, Liz's boots. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. That was a really cute YouTube video. We'll see if Monica can find it and put it in the show notes. But yeah, you guys wear some serious footwear.
Yeah, so if I had a backyard, I would want it to be a pretty decent size in order to have some chickens, and I would definitely keep the chickens. So they make these little chicken runs that you can get that attach to the chicken house, and we have some illustrations in the book about showing people a couple different versions of that. So, you know, you can just have a stationary chicken house, but then you can make these little basically safe areas for the chickens to run around that's covered so that a hawk can't fly down and so that they're getting fresh bugs and grass all the time. And then they also make these little mobile coops too that can move around your yard. So the chicken poop can still fertilize the grass and the chickens are scratching at your ground and you'll have like amazing grass. But if it's too concentrated, you know, you have to move them on a regular basis because you don't want it to get too concentrated because that could burn the grass. So you want to keep it separated.
I have a couple chicken questions from some of my readers that I don't think we've actually covered yet. So Paleo Sisters Journey asked, how many chickens would be a good number to start with for beginners?
Okay, so that all depends on how many eggs you want. So if you think of a chicken is about an egg a day per chicken, so like 4 to 6 would be a good number to start with for somebody that, you know, eats a decent amount of eggs or maybe has some neighbors that they can give eggs to. So you don't want too few because then in the winter, if you only have 1 or 2 chickens, they need to keep each other warm a little bit in the house. So like 4 to 6 is a good number for starters.
And then I have another question from Jennifer, and she says all of her hens lay in the nesting box except one, and she used to, but after her long molt, she's been finding eggs in random places all over the yard. Is there a way to train her to lay in the box again?
Yes. So I saw this question too. So I thought I should just explain what a molt is because that's another really common question that I get from people. So a molt is when the chickens lose all their feathers and it happens about once a year. And it really freaks people out because they're not prepared and all of a sudden they think their chicken is going to die, you know. And it looks like a chicken like that you would buy in the store. It's kind of scary looking. And it's really just a natural process. And they're getting, you know, they're refreshing their feathers and getting new feathers in. And so what I would recommend is they make these little wooden eggs, which you can put in nesting boxes. And it actually encourages the chickens to want to lay eggs where they see other eggs. So that would be one thing, is just to buy a handful of these wooden eggs and try to encourage this chicken, you know, to go over there. And then the other thing would be to try to make wherever she is laying, like maybe it's in a rock wall or it's very rare that a chicken will just lay an egg like in the middle of the grass. Like they usually will try to find a safe place to do it. And so wherever her little places are that she's finding, just to make them inhospitable, like put a box over it or cover it with something so that she can't get in there. That would be my recommendations.
Okay, so I have one other question about chickens because everyone has chicken questions, including me, because they're probably one of the more accessible ways of raising your own protein, whether you're doing it for the meat or you're doing it for – they're a lot less intimidating than having goats or pigs in your backyard.
Right.
So this is from Rachel, and she says, we have 8 hens now, and in spring we would like to get 12 more. We have tried to introduce breeds together before without much success. I understand there will be fighting when they're trying to establish a new pecking order, but are there some secrets or tips to make the transition period smoother?
So there is that is legitimate, that there is an actual pecking order, and that some chickens, so chickens will look for the one that looks different and they will try to get rid of it. So that's just chickens. That's the way they are. So they make icky poop and they are not so nice to each other. So that's just that's the realities of chickens. So there's a couple ways to do it, but then there's also a couple reasons why you might not want to do it. So it can cause fighting. And then secondly, you can introduce disease to your flock. So if these one, you know, if this other group of chickens have already had this one disease and then you're introducing them to your flock, which is not immune to that other disease, we've seen bad things happen and we never accept other chickens into our flock. So we have our flock and that's our flock. But if you still want to do it, we have had luck in the past with introducing them at night. So you literally take them and place them in the coop at nighttime when the other chickens are sleeping, and then they wake up and they look around and they're like, oh.
You weren't there last night, but all right.
Yeah. And then to try to get the same breeds. So if you are just starting out, getting mixed breeds is totally fine and they usually get along just great. But if you're introducing a whole new set of chickens to your existing chickens and all your chickens are Rhode Island Reds, I would probably recommend getting more Rhode Island Reds and not getting different breeds that are all kinds of different colors, because that's just another excuse for the chickens not to like those new chickens.
Dana, what's the breed of chickens that lays the Easter eggs? Because those are my kids' favorites.
Yeah, those are Araucanas, and they're really pretty. They lay a blue egg, and then there's another one that are green egg layers. So this is brand new. So I don't know if you guys have ever seen.
All the farms around me have the green egg layers.
Yeah, us like, too.
The farmer's market cool. is just full of green eggs.
Yeah, and I forget what they're called, but I on the other podcast, so I run this podcast called Modern Farm Girls with Liz Wolf, and I interview farmers. So I interview Liz and I do the show about once a month, but then in between, I'll interview a female farmer in between. And I interviewed the woman who runs Fresh Eggs Daily. Do you know that blog? It's a really great Facebook page and blog. But anyway,
no, I've never heard of it.
I've got her coming up soon on our show, and it was a really fascinating interview, and she talked about all the different color eggs that she gets, and it's a really great resource for people that are looking to have backyard chickens.
Awesome. So, speaking of Easter eggs, mm-hmm. there's a couple other things in your book that I want to point out to people. And, I know we're hitting our hour mark, which we're really commonly known for at this point in the podcast. But one of the things that you mentioned at the very beginning of the podcast that I thought was really awesome about the book is that you do cover some lifestyle things, just kind of getting back to basics and natural. And you have naturally dyed Easter eggs, which would be a great thing to do with the eggs that you either, you know, buy or grow yourself. And there was also beeswax candles, which would be fantastic if you were doing honeybees. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? Mm-hmm. And maybe also while you're talking, you could talk about some of the recipes and how you came up with them. You mentioned the rooster stew, which I actually noticed when I was paging through as one of the things that caught my eye. But one of the most amazing things about the book from my perspective is the photography is fantastic. It makes you want to eat everything, but then it's obviously also so seasonal, which I think quite a few of the paleo books are doing and acknowledging these days. But I think that you did a great job of kind of focusing those recipes to encourage people to use seasonal produce. And that's because if you know the source of your food, then it's seasonal, because otherwise it's coming off a boat somewhere from a different country in order, or maybe for those of us on the East Coast, California. But maybe you could talk a little bit about that and tell us kind of what your favorite recipes or stories related to the recipes are. So people get a sense of it's not just a homesteading book. It's also
Oh, right. It actually is primarily a cookbook, and I just wanted people to kind of get a better sense of how to grow their food. And then it grew into this kind of three-part book, like you said. So it's how to grow it, how to cook it, and then the lifestyle piece of sort of how to live it. So so in the lifestyle piece, we had some really cool projects. So my photographer came with us. We did a clam bake on an island in Gloucester in the river off of Gloucester, which is a seaport town in Massachusetts that has no electricity and it's all tiny houses. It was like my dream. This place is amazing. And so we did this beautiful clam bake right there, right on the shore. We went camping into these other little tiny houses. So, that's in there too. I have instructions on how kids can build a fairy house, on how to build a fire. So just kind of like basic, like you said, the how to color Easter eggs. So a lot of family activities that people have just sort of forgotten how to do. And a lot of people, I just think it would be really fun for people to reconnect with their kids in a really basic way.
Those things are definitely like, I can see myself doing those a lot easier than I can see myself keeping things alive. So for me, like that was a really interesting and awesome part of the book.
Yeah. And the coloring Easter eggs, I have to say, is really easy. Like it's really cool. And the coolest color. So the robin's egg blue ones, that's from red cabbage. Isn't that cool? So it's like you just boil some red cabbage and it turns the egg blue.
I was really super lazy last year and just went to the farmer's market and got like a variety of colors of Easter eggs from chickens. So this year I told myself I was going to make it up to the boys and we would actually do a natural dye. So I'm looking forward to trying it out.
Yeah. And it's, like I said, it's not hard. So that's a nice... That's a good one. I do have instructions on how to make goat's milk soap, and that is a little trickier and it involves lye. So that's not something that I would recommend as a family activity. And I mentioned that in the book that it's more for people that just want to try something really cool because making your own soap is super cool. But
I used to make soap when I was a kid.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I guess my parents let me play with lye, I guess, how that worked. I mean, I remember measuring out the lye and making my own soap, like olive oil soaps, because I don't think we had very much like natural, like, well, olive oil is a natural fat, but we didn't have very many animal fats in the house back then. But yeah, I remember trying to wash the lye off my hands.
Wow.
So good times. Yeah.
So, and then the recipes, I went through three seasons. So instead of spring, summer, fall, winter, because winter is really like right now, there's nothing growing. There is no winter season on a farm. It's really winter just carries over whatever storage from fall. So I broke it into three seasons. And that way too, Sarah down south, you know, whatever's early season for her is also early season for me, but you know, I don't have tomatoes at the same time she does. So I didn't want to say like spring, summer, fall, because then that, you know, takes it away
that
a little
bit.
So what I did was my photographer Heidi came to the farm every other week for an entire growing season. And we shot whatever was in season then. So we did a portrait of just about every vegetable that we grow. And then all the dishes start, the dishes in the book are pretty much laid out in the whole succession of when she shot the book. So it's really cool. And I should mention too, that she shot the whole book in film. So it's not digital, which I think is really cool because the colors in the pictures are just really rich and
dreamy. They look dreamy.
Yeah, they're just images that you can't get from digital. And I think it's really nice too, where I'm talking so much about like analog living, you know, like kind of just like that whole idea again of downshifting and everything, to have these images shot with the richness of film. And I happen to have an art background too. So it was really fun for me to work on this book because it's just so much fun to art direct a book.
Yeah, and the hard work obviously came through. So maybe you could tell us each of your family members' favorite recipes from the book. Like, what do your kids request over and over again that you happen to make during the book? Because I know that happens with Sarah and I. Like, there's something that we make in recipe development, and then all of a sudden the kids are like, I need this every week.
I think there's a recipe called rosemary potato stacks, which probably isn't in the copy. You guys are going to be getting your preview copies very soon. I know you have the sample in front of you. So that is amazing. There are these thin slices of potato they're almost like potatoes, Anna, but I just stack these coins of potatoes and roast them at a really high temperature. And so they're kind of crispy and my kids just go crazy. They call them potato chips, even though they're not deep fried or anything. I'm trying to think of other dishes. I mean, I make hash for breakfast a lot. My husband actually, for a farmer who grows his own eggs, he actually doesn't like eggs for breakfast. So even though I make eggs often for my kids and myself, my husband just, he doesn't like, you know, just some people just don't like eggs. So I make him hash, like almost, you know, I'll just make like 2 pounds of meat and, you know, mix it up with different spices and different vegetables. And so I have a couple different types of hash in the book. I have one with cinnamon and sweet potatoes, and I have another one with the curries and potatoes. And those are his definite favorites for breakfast. Mm. And then I can't wait until spring comes because the nettle soup. So I have also, in addition to vegetables that you can grow, I also have quite a few wild things that you can just gather. So you could just go find them. And I give you tips on where to find them and how to find them. And so nettles.
That would be fun.
Mm-hmm. Nettles are, well, maybe not so much fun for kids to go find. Maybe that might be more fun for you to go find because.
Oh, no, I'm not doing that by myself.
Stinging nettles. So they actually sting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I grew up around stinging nettle. I have very extensive experience with stinging nettle. Mm-hmm. And that's definitely a adult supervision required task.
Yeah. I mean, you do not
want to accidentally touch it with any exposed skin.
Yeah. It just feels like a little bee sting, but you definitely don't want the kids involved with that. But as soon as you cook it, that all goes away and it makes the brightest, greenest, most silkiest soup. And it's like supposed to be really good for adrenal support. So, but there is one for kids that's if you can find a black birch tree in your area. I'm not sure if they, you know, I should have looked to see if they grow down south. I'm not sure how far.
I'm not sure that I've seen one.
This is our new geocaching. Like this is what we're going to do. We're going to like Google the things that you say we can find, see what they look like, and then go about gathering. This sounds like, honestly, my boys love adventures. Like this sounds like a lot of fun.
So, and this one really pays off. So you find this black birch tree and you snap off the stems just at the end of the growing part. And what you end up doing is, and this is great for the boys, especially my son who is just like fidgety all the time and needs to be moving like all the time. So you just put him to work and he tore through this. You peel the bark off the branches and then and it smells like root beer. Like literally that is root beer smell. It's crazy. And then you put it in just a jar, a tall like canning jar with water, and you leave it out in the sun for a day or two, and it's tea. It's like a root beer flavored tea.
Fun.
Doing that.
Yeah, it's super fun.
I might have to come visit you guys in order to do it, but I'm doing that.
So we'll have to look it up and see if there's black birch cheese growing in your areas.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, Dana, thank you so much for coming on and talking with us about not just your book, but also some tips for people in terms of homesteading in general. Maybe you could just kind of remind everyone where they could find you if they're looking for more information.
Sure. Definitely. Thank you. So I do a podcast with Liz Wolf, which is super fun, and it's called The Modern Farm Girls. And Liz is also a nutritionist in the paleo scene and real food scene, and she is a homesteader as well. So we have a lot of fun with that. And then my blog is sustainabledish.com. And I'm also really active on Instagram. I love Instagram. So I'm Sustainable Dish.
Gorgeous farm photos on Instagram.
I was going to say, I love your Instagram. You have the most beautiful photos.
Thanks. Yeah. So I try to post at least once a day, but it's usually more often than that. And it's anything from what I'm eating to wacky things like the goat just got her ear torn and needs to get it sewn up again or whatever. So just farm life, basically. So, and then all the other links are on my blog, so people can find my videos and the podcast and everything else right from my blog. So if people pre-order the book, they can get if they go to my website, sustainabledish.com/books, and there's a link right there where they can enter their order number from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or pals.com, and they will be able to download a sneak peek preview copy of the book. And the very last page also has tons of coupons to paleo-minded companies like Barefoot Provisions and Fat Face Skincare and I'm trying to think, Pure Indian Food. So a bunch of them. So there's all kinds of offers, and it's definitely worth it if you're thinking about getting the book to just go ahead and pre-order it now.
That's awesome.
That is really awesome. So everyone, go pre-order.
Awesome. Well, again, thank you so much for joining us on the Paleo View. It was wonderful to talk with you. And I know you've got a lot of snow where you are now. So good luck with spring coming soon.
Thank you. Thanks. It was so much fun. Thanks for having me.
Thanks very much.
Thank you for listening to the Paleo View. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. You can also support us by shopping for our favorite paleo products on the sidebars of our individual websites or by donating through PayPal.
You good, Sarah? I was going to...
Oh, I have more chicken questions. You going to try and transition to another topic? I'm not done. Okay.
Matt's going to have to cut that out. Go ahead.
No. It'll go in the bloopers. It's fine.
Okay, as a total aside, you talked about making things out of goat's milk twice, and it took everything that I had to not talk about the time that I made cheese from my extra breast milk before I knew about the ability to donate my milk. It was not fun, and the cheese was gross, so I was like, I don't know if I would want to, like, make things out of goat's milk, because that one time I made unpastured human milk product, it was not pleasant.
Ew.
Pretty much. I was thankful. We had run out of freezer space, and I was like, I don't feel comfortable just throwing this away. And I, after that, I actually looked into what can I do with the milk and found out that I could donate it and, you know, got hooked up with someone. But there was a day where we had tried to make human mozzarella, and it